Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
This is Dan Witherspoon of the Mormon Matters Podcast, welcoming you to the third section of kind of a cooperative endeavor between Mormon Stories, A Thoughtful Faith, and Mormon Matters. Section one, we're kind of calling section one, is an interview that Gina Colvin did with John DeLynn. Really did a nice, wonderful job of taking John all the way through his journey in life, as well as with Mormon Stories and his plans and things like that. And so it's really great to have that out there, along with what Lindsay Hansen Park did with John at the Sunstone Symposium. So if anybody who wants to really dive into John DeLynn and his life, I highly recommend you go to Mormon Stories to get the Lindsay and the Gina one, or just to go to Gina's A Thoughtful Faith podcast and get that one. What John then did was interview me about a week prior to when we're talking now about my journey and my way of putting the world together and my sort of approach to Mormonism. It was another typical long, fun interview, not always comfortable to, you know, field every question that sometimes comes from a place of asking or something that is such a different worldview or whatever than what I'm thinking in. But I was glad to do it and appreciate John and, you know, putting that out there in the world as a way of helping me in kind of my journey and kind of, you know, why Mormonism still feels like a comfortable enough home for me. Good to have that out there.
I just felt like you really represented your side in many good ways. So I love that interview.
Well, thank you. And it was fun, but also not fun to do, like I said. and I think some of the ways that I'll phrase questions or something here, you'll kind of feel the dynamic of all these kind of clarifying and stuff here and there as we converse. So really what this third section we're imagining is because we have John's story, we're going to kind of skip over that. I will reference to certain things that Gina and Lindsay asked him as we go. So this will be my chance to ask John a bit more specifics about his own beliefs, the own way that he weighs his role as a leader, as an influencer in the world. I just want to hear a lot more about his Mormonism, about his own personal beliefs and things like that. And then I think what we'll be able to do is share with each other a little bit more about places where we agree and disagree and things like that. So welcome. Thanks for joining me for this. I'm really excited to interview you now.
Thanks, Dan. I've been wanting to have a bit of a back and forth for a while, and I'm happy to be here again.
Great. Thanks, brother. So, John, I don't know if you remember exactly this one little moment during your interview of me where I kind of compared our temperaments, and I kind of said that you seem to me to have an activist temperament, and there's no judgment involved when it comes to temperament. Some people are naturally extroverted or introverted, or, you know, there's all sorts of different things, and there's gifts and there's drawbacks with each one. But I was wondering how well you related to me kind of saying that whatever John DeLynn is, when he feels something, whether it's enthusiasm or disgust or you know, like feels somebody's pain or something like that, that it's almost impossible for you to do anything but kind of come at it like at 90 miles per hour. You know what I mean? It's like, I've got to do something about this. You know, I'm feeling it. I'm either I love it or I hate it. And somehow or other, I can't be silent. Did that fit comfortably with you? Does that describe you?
I noted that, and I remember feeling mixed about it. On a superficial level, I think it is true that I'm a very passionate person, that I probably have a temperament like when I think about Peter in the New Testament, you know, jumping out and trying to walk on water, or like nice. Cutting off the ear of the, you know, soldier.
Right.
I do think that I sometimes have that temperament. And I also agree, Dan, that a big difference maybe between me and others, and maybe it is not a difference, but the fact that, you know, 10 years ago, maybe 15 years ago, I started really tapping in to the pain side of, you know, of people's struggle in their LDS and Mormon journeys. Mm-hmm. And then as a therapist, where I'm sitting across the room, you know, therapy room, from people contemplating suicide, of having their marriages end, of dealing with masturbation or homosexuality or eating disorders, you know, difficulties that they associate with their Mormon upbringing, that, you know, what that does is it makes me feel like, if I'm just to say, well, the church works for me, you know, and as a white heterosexual, you know, we talked about this in your interview, as a white, tall, you know, middle-aged, upper, you know, sort of middle class, you know, white male. I'm forgetting all my descriptors.
Straight.
Yeah. It's really easy for me to say, well, the church works for me. But as I tap in so regularly now as a therapist to all the ways that the church really hurts people in meaningful ways, then I feel like I have to be vocal about that. Or else I fear that I'm being complicit in their pain and suffering, and just sort of saying, well, it works for me and I enjoy it, but it's painful for other people. And so I do think that pressures me. But the thing is, I know that you also talk to a lot of people all the time and have a strong sense and care for that pain as well. So I don't know. Temperament certainly comes into play here, but I'll also just say that, you know, one of the references that you made is one of a long game versus a short game.
Uh-huh, right.
And what I heard from that is sort of like, my defensive part of me hears you say, oh, well, you're impetuous, you're impatient, and you're just playing the short game. But maybe I'm, you know, Dan, playing the wiser, more patient, more mature, longer game. And I don't know, and I don't mean that that's what you really intended, but right. That's what my insecure sort of parts heard, and I would say that sort of assumes that there's one right end. You know what I mean? And I think for some people it is probably right for them to try and stay and make it work, and I think for others it's just really right for them to leave the church. And so I don't think there's one end for every person. I think it's the short game for some, the long game for others, and vice versa.
Yeah, yeah. I hear that critique, and I hear that you might have heard that way. I guess, you know, another area, let's kind of fold two things that I had to ask you. Another area that I would reference quite a bit, and I seemed like I was trying to draw you into a conversation with me when you were, you know, really more on the mode of interviewing me, is I kept talking about, you know, developmental theory and Fowler and stages of faith and things like that. And I wanted to hear your take on, you know, either Fowler itself or just, you know, as a doctor, having a doctorate in psychology. I'm sure you've, you know, gone into Piaget and Erickson and Kohlberg and, you know, Gilligan and everybody who's, you know, a developmental theorist and stuff like that. And of course, in that there is sort of an assumption, and this is where maybe part of your critique is, that, you know, that everyone, if the human journey proceeds in a way where certain tasks are hit at certain times and things like that, that person has a better chance for a fully flourishing life. And so take the faith stuff out of it. That's kind of a developmental model that simply says pathologies can be avoided if good things happen at the right points. But I guess I'm trying to get you to argue or to suggest, because it's part of this answer of the long game versus the short game. Are you at all a fan of developmental theory? Do you think that there's something to it because in some ways it is a long game theory?
Yeah. So I definitely have had sort of a base level, you know, training and trying to understand Piaget and Kohlberg and Erikson. Fowler, actually, I don't think was ever mentioned in my 6 years of, of psychology training, just because generally I find, psychology faculty uncomfortable discussing religion, even at Utah State.
Yeah.
So yeah, I certainly respect just the idea of sort of the discipline of developmental psychology, the idea that there are common sort of developmental milestones that we progress through, and yeah, there's no way that I would want to deny that, because I think we're all human and we all share 99% of our DNA. And a lot of our experiences and journeys are very similar. So I do respect developmental psychology, and I do have a respect for Fowler in the sense that I think I don't think Fowler would even claim to represent everyone's experience. But I think, you know, most people are religious, even today, 80% of the world maybe or more would claim to be religious or spiritual in some way. And I think Fowler does a really good job of describing a very common developmental trajectory for many people. So I'm with you all the way through that. And I would even say that there were times where my interview with you and Tom Kimball was really, really important and meaningful to me. As I was trying to make the church work. And I think Fowler is a very, very useful sort of paradigm for people who have decided that they either need or want to make, for example, Mormonism work. And they're trying to move out of stage four, which I kind of associate with anger and with confusion and with doubt and with feelings of darkness, kind of that dark night of the soul thing. They're trying to transition away from literalism and simplicity and dogmatic binary thinking. And four represents sort of that difficult journey. And then five on the other side represents sort of this mature, symbolic, metaphorical, deeper, wiser, more patient, more loving, more expansive sort of view of, you know, their Mormonism and their spirituality. I love those ideas and that frame for many people. Where everything kind of falls short, both just LDS church participation and Fowler, is, you know, what do we do for the people for whom those models just don't work, you know? And we've talked a little bit about. Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say, even when the model itself says you're looking at decades worth of transition here.
Well, I think we'd have to dig more into what we mean by Fowler, but let me just try and give a really, short answer just to make sure we don't take too long on this.
Sure.
And that's that, you know, when I think about Fowler, you know, Fowler stage five, I kind of think about, you know, you. And not that you would claim stage five status, but just this idea that let's be big, let's be expansive, let's be charitable, let's be wise, let's be patient, let's find the symbolic metaphorical value. I think that's all laudable and worthy for someone staying engaged. And I think that's a fine trajectory for somebody who still values sort of a spiritual and or a religious paradigm. Where I don't know if Fowler really fits is with the people that sort of say something to the effect of either, I don't believe in a spiritual realm. I don't believe in sort of a dualistic realm. I think that this is probably the only life we get. I think that this is our only existence. I don't know that there's probably not a God, or if there is, nobody knows. I don't think there's a true church. And, you know, my emphasis is going to be just living the best life that I can. And, you know, they sort of look at religion. You know, I think it's a reasonable conclusion to make that religion is worth keeping and engaging in. I also think it's a very reasonable conclusion to reach to say too much baggage, a fraudulent foundation, too much
for all religion or for a particular religion
for any. Okay. I think if someone concludes this about Catholicism or evangelical Christianity or Jehovah's Witness or Scientology or Mormonism or Orthodox Judaism, I could see someone just saying, look, it's not what it claims to be. It is an inefficient way to be good in the world. There's plenty of ways to be good without having to be religious. The religion hurts too many people. And I can't justify my participation just based on how many people are being hurt. The leaders are not what they claim to be. They're actually bad leaders. And the teachings are often really harmful. And then in my case, they kick me out. And so I think that someone can kind of look at a religion and say, hey, this is worth preserving. And I think it's equally legitimate to say, you know what, this is too damaging and inefficient, and it's at its core not true. And so it's not worth trying to preserve engagement. Now, if Fowler allows for someone to become sort of post-Mormon and leave the church behind, then we can both say we still embrace Fowler. But if what we mean by stage five Fowler is it necessitates a clinging to sort of, you know, LDS church participation, then I would say I don't think there's one path there. I think there's two paths. And this is the thing that when you and I have struggled, even in the past few months, it's that I feel like, you know, through my support of Stay LDS, through my support of Mormon Matters, through A Thoughtful Faith, I think I've been really clear in saying, hey, staying is legitimate and I want to support those who stay. And I don't want to talk down to them. And maybe I have, but I don't want to. And I want to say there needs to be this path for people. And sometimes when I've been a little bit less patient or frustrated in my dialogues with you, it's when I felt either you condescending about people who decide to leave, or sort of, you know, saying that it's the higher path, or saying that, you know, that sort of challenging people who make that decision. And I don't want to challenge someone who decides to stay, but I also don't want to hear you challenge someone who's really been thoughtful about this and has decided that they want to leave. I don't want them to feel like they're taking the short game or have a bad temperament or quitting too early or less deep or less wise or less noble, because I think you can leave and have it be very noble, very wise, very deep, and very much a short and a long game as well. You know what I'm saying?
There's a lot to respond to there.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to monologue.
I guess what I want to say is I do remember that section of your interview with me. It seemed like it was a theme probably 20, 30 minutes. And it was an uncomfortable time for me when you were kept talking about coming across as more mature or this is better, you know, and I spoke about feelings of people can feel judged by that, and I recognize that, and I appreciate always hearing that those kinds of things there, but it's such a difficult thing to respond to, because it certainly doesn't feel that same way within my own head. So for instance, on the key issue, I think that we just were getting at in kind of your time before I take my long term to respond is this issue of, you know, fast versus slow decisions. The general point that I would always want to make is I don't sure it's smart to make any kind of decision, major life decision, when you're in the middle of the stress or when you finally realize that you've just been under this great burden and, anyway, when you're traumatized or something like that, you know, they talk about don't get divorced or, you know, don't make these major life decisions after the death of a loved one's or a job change or something like that. That's the sort of the level to me why I can't quite give you, it's just as valid to leave fast as it is to leave slow. That's it. But in individual cases, golf, there's obviously going to be circumstances where that is probably the right decision. But then there's the whole Fowler section that I think that in many ways you do misunderstand Fowler, because of course he would say post-Mormon paths are fine. He would also claim that his whole paradigm fits the atheist worldview, because it really isn't anything to do with beliefs. It's more how you center in the universe, however it is that you view your connection with centers of value and power and things like this. So for instance, by stage three, we've mostly all of us, by adulthood, we've inherited a worldview, and it's been the story that we were told, and now we are able at this point in our, you know, late adolescence or early adulthood to basically tell a story. But it wasn't our story. It was the story that was presented to us. It's the story that mostly relies upon authority granted to teachers, parents, church leaders, etc. So the stage four is not so much an angry stage or something like that. It's that stage that moves from somebody else's authority to you weighing it for yourself, and you really truly owning your decisions. And so that involves a lot of exploration. That involves a questioning of one by one all the assumptions. And we do this with everything. I mean, all of us grew up with a naive view of American history and, you know, American exceptionalism and all those different things. We all grew up with a naive view of our family, because our family has a story about who we DeLynns are or who we Weatherspoons are. And slowly but surely, as we enter into these adulthood stages, we start to see that these are far, far more complex and things like that. And we begin to shift from taking somebody else's word to it to where I'm really wrestling with it myself. And so I tend to want to think that those periods of shifting from others as authoritative to ourselves, I do think, John, to be healthy, it has to take a long time, and it has to be one of constant back and forth and things like this. And so sometimes I feel like those who do shift, and again, this isn't like a value judgment or anything. I think it's just, we do that, and I tried on things for size all the time. Luckily, I was in grad school where I kind of had, you know, both sides presented to me all the time, but I would try things on that were quite rejecting and quite, you know, going to extreme rhetoric or something and making claims, and it felt good, and it was a powerful move to say, I am no longer, in the group think, or however you'd want to say it. But it takes a long time, and so I worry sometimes when somebody makes the decision or the choice to shift, that they're just shifting one authority for another. The authority of religion and authority of their parents and authority of their upbringing for the authority of Sam Harris and Dawkins and science as able to do it. So for instance, you know, when somebody like Sam Harris says, you know, religion, the space for religion is getting smaller and smaller and smaller because science is going around, and it's showing that, you know, all these things that you thought were a spiritual experience were really just, you know, neurons firing and chemicals flooding, and you know, science has explained all these things away, so there's hardly any room for God left. That's an assumption that, to me, needs to be challenged, and yet I don't think that sometimes people do it. Now, we did spend some time in our podcast together when you were talking to me about those who haven't had genuine spiritual experiences. And I do want to ask you in a minute about the one that you shared with Gina about the Holy Ghost, you know, feeling so strong at that state conference and things. But I guess what I want to say is, you know, I don't want people to go too quickly into saying Sam Harris has it figured out and science has it all figured out, because I think that there's fundamentally, and again, until you can taste it for yourself, I'm not sure, you know, that there is a way to really win this argument, you know. But I would just say, I always think slowly staying in the question is the best, and that's going to be some of the areas I want to talk with you. How is it that you're staying in the question versus kind of closing things down? So that was my long response. So go for it. Go back.
Okay. No. And let me just do a quick counter response. It'll be super quick. First of all, I want to acknowledge that I'm no way, even an intermediate Fowler sort of scholar. I just have a very cursory understanding of Fowler. So I'm going to concede that. But I also am going to say that I do know that Fowler sure. can accommodate an atheistic or a post-Mormon worldview. So I will say that I know enough to say that. And so I do think that there, and so this may have something to do with how Fowler's often discussed, but I do also know that Fowler, stage three versus stage four has to do with developing your own intrinsic authority versus relying on the authority of others. I am aware of all that, but I do think that in the short change of sort of common Mormon internet discourse, stage three Fowler is associated with TBM. Stage four Fowler is often associated with sort of the doubting, questioning sort of faith crisis kind of stuff. And then stage five is often associated with sort of the Phil Barlow, Richard Bushman, Dan Witherspoon, Terrell and Fiona Gibbons. We found a way to make it work. Now, maybe that's just a complete disservice to what Fowler tried to say. But I think it's helpful for you to make the distinction between, you know, you're saying yeah. the pace that you go, right? And the destination. And I think sometimes maybe that's lost in how you carry forth your message. Because to me, and this may be my confirmation bias, right? But when I hear Dan Witherspoon talk, what often comes into my ears is stay, 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 don't give up, keep in it, stay with it, stay active, go to church, you know, stay engaged. And what I'm hearing you say is you're actually trying to articulate something deeper, which is stay in the question, don't move too quickly, slow down.
And well, or to me, really, it's more don't write off the idea that you might have a spirit, that it might be types of information that can lead to a fully flourishing life that are not necessarily, you know, accessed through scientific or rationality. So that's what I'm more interested in than stay Mormon. Is like, if you'd leave Mormonism, leave healthy.
Yeah.
and leave a version of Mormonism that is as rich a version as you can possibly, in other words, be fair to both sides of the Mormon thing and not just the pain side.
Yeah. And I do hear you say that too. So I'm not trying to say that you're not supportive of people who leave. I would just say that, and this is going to be a bit repetitive, sometimes when I hear you speak, the message that I take away, whether you intend it or not, is don't leave the church, stay and stick it out. Even though either I'm mishearing you or what you're really saying is stay in the question, go slowly, take a deeper approach. That's just what I take away. Now, maybe others don't hear that, but I do hear that.
A little, it's there. But it would be tied more to me, like, you know, as you journey with your own spirit and as you gain the confidence in your own choices and decision, you can engage Mormonism from more of a place of good health, of security within your own heart and mind. And therefore, the things that trigger, the things that are so painful and things like that, you're able to in some ways not embrace them, but you're able to kind of meet them with grace, with love, compassion, with a memory of when you were that person, all those kinds of things. And what I think you'll find is the thing when you mentioned, you know, the Givens, I just released for Mormon Matters this talk that Carol Givens gave at a museum in New York as my last Mormon Matters. But it's when there's these powerful, huge, ridiculously empowering and ennobling ideas in Mormonism that, again, you can start to see again, and all the low-level ways, all the, you know, retrograde ways, all the ways that culture crushes creative thinking and, you know, stick with the brethren and, you know, all these different ways that Mormonism does, you know, the more that you're comfortable with your, in your own spirit and stuff like that, to me, it's like you can see through both eyes. You can see those expansive things at the same time you see all the retrograde things. And again, ultimately that leads for a healthy spiritual life. And so the reason I would actually say stay, though, John, more than anything else, is if you were not a convert, in other words, if you were grown into this religion and you have all these family relationships and you have all these friendships and everything's been built around it, I think ultimately, again, time will have to prove this. I think ultimately, if you can push through to that place of confidence within yourself and meeting Mormonism to where it's not running you, but you have your own choice and you're always able to kind of see the forces that are, you know, trying to get you to be this way or that way, I think ultimately you're going to have a much richer life when you've kept all those family connections and things like that and just sort of felt spiritually independent of all the bullcrap.
And I'll just say that there are people who have found a way to, let's just say, become stage five Mormons. Let's just say Bill Bradshaw. Okay.
Okay.
These are some of the people that I respect most in the world. Like, I love these people or Toby Pingree, you know, whoever, right.
Sure.
And there's females, you know, Molly Bennion or Carolyn Pearson, right?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. So, Jana Reese, absolutely. So, I want to say sort of both. And I want to say that for some, there's incredible rewards to be made by becoming that deeper, wiser self. And it's the whole Why the Church is as True as the Gospel essay by Eugene England. And I think that's a totally valid approach. And the only two things I just want to sort of reinforce again is, number one, what I'm sensitive to is any language that, it's one thing to say, hey, you know, this is worth considering, which I think you do, right? Mm-hmm. Anytime I feel the language goes over to, this is what the deeper and the wiser people do, this is the superior path, the other path is short or cheap or lesser than, that's when I get sensitive. Because I think on the flip side, and this is going to be me being a tiny bit repetitive, I think it's also perfectly legitimate for someone to say, you know, they find out immediately that the Book of Abraham isn't a translation, the Book of Mormon isn't historical, to just say, look, I want to go on this journey of wisdom, but the church is based on fraud. And if that's the case, then I don't want to be connected with it because it's not true and it's based on deception. And I think that is a legitimate path. Now, would I also agree with you that then they should seek to become a deep and a wise and a patient and a loving and an expansive person? Absolutely. You and I and Fowler are sort of all in agreement on, if that's what stage five means, we're all in agreement. But I think it's a equally legitimate decision to just say, nope, the church is too harmful to people, too inefficient, not what it claims to be, brethren are too messed up, this is not worth staying in. It's too harmful to me, too harmful to others, waste of time. And I don't think that's in any way necessarily an inferior or less wise path. Even if they make that decision in a matter of weeks, for me, the bigger question is, do they go on the journey of soul expansion versus whether or not they stay in the church?
Right. And whether, again, the issue of, can it be done within Mormonism as easily as it can be done without Mormonism, right?
Okay, and that is just a matter, that's kind of where the pioneer thing comes in, because absolutely there are convenient things about staying. I mean, you're talking to somebody who, you know, after a 15-year faith crisis, right, would still be active in the church at some level if they hadn't have excommunicated me. I mean,
right.
I and my family were active in June of 2014 when we received those letters. And so I see that, but at the same time, I've kind of lost my train of thought. Tell me what your prompt was again.
Well, I was just like, you know, closing that section by simply saying that the question is whether or not it's
easier. Oh, okay, easier, yeah.
Without.
Yeah, and I would just say that For some, it's totally like a cost-benefit analysis. You can look at utility and just say, oh, man, if I leave, I lose my spouse, I lose my kids, I have no friends, maybe I lose my job, maybe I'm mentally ill or really depressed, and I lose the support of the church. Like, I can see a cost-benefit analysis where staying is absolutely the best and wisest and easiest and smartest choice. But I know a lot of people who really would have liked to have stayed. And yes, it would have been easier, right? But for them, it wasn't a matter of being weak or wanting to sin or any of that stuff. It was just purely a matter of, I can't do it. I feel like I'm lying. I feel like I'm deceptive. I feel like I'm, you know, either a second-class citizen, or I have to deceive them with the temple recommend questions to stay. And I feel like to hide who I am, I have to stay silent in church and really miscommunicate who I am or hide who I am to my leaders. I can't pay the money. And ultimately, I just feel complicit in the harm. And for those people, yeah, it can be excruciatingly hard to leave. Not for all. For some, they leave and it's just amazing. But yeah, for some, it's super painful to leave. But that doesn't mean that the easier choice is the best choice. You know what I'm saying? Sometimes the harder choice, even if it's painful and more difficult, is still the right one for some people, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And again, partly, you know, we can't escape our own autobiographies and things like that. And I, you know, for me, I'd felt like I was so in that question for at least a 4-year period. It was the period when my son was about ages 11 to 15 that that was such a wrestle for me. But I'm so glad that I had that wrestle. I'm so glad that I stuck through that. I guess in some ways I hear you, but I'm still thinking for those that in a matter of weeks make these decisions. And, you know, you use the word because it's a fraud or there's a deception here. And I definitely have that on my list to talk with you about, you know, using words like that and exactly how fair those are, because those are rhetorical words as much as they are, you know, describing some factual thing. Let's move out of this particular one, easier or something like that. My rhetoric has always been, all things being equal, if you're going to, at some point, if you desire a rich and full spiritual life, I'm always trying to just simply say, I think Mormonism has the richness, it's got the scriptures, it's got ritual, it's got community, it's got everything that can serve you well in that. But again, that stage 4, what it is, John, it's becoming spiritually independent. It's becoming, you know, it's emotionally independent. It's, you know, it's, you talk about it as a differentiation between you and your parents is one of those healthy psychological steps. Well, it's differentiation between you and everything else. And when you've got that healthiness, and of course you're going to be going through that if you're sticking in with the Mormon game and all, you're going to have that there. But once you've differentiated to where you own your own relationship with God, your own relationship with your parents, your own decision making about who I want to become and here are my values and things like that, then it's so, you know, it's so much easier than I think you can imagine on this side of the question. It's so much easier on that side of that wrestle to simply say, you know, Mormonism, I'm going to live it on my own terms. And, you know, I'm going to be sad when my tradition isn't as expansive as I know it can be and things like that. I'm going to rejoice when it is on all those, you know, on all those things. And I guess that, to me, the ultimately staying or something, it's not a question of I do it because it's easier. I do it because it's part of my joy. And I think I mentioned that in the podcast. And I just want that language to come through too. I found the joy of connection with God that, you know, makes all the crap.
Yeah.
Not always joyful, but at least it's not just a, like, you know, it's not like I'm making it work.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, yeah. So go for it.
And I would just say, just to kind of close out this section from my point of view, I do not have the position that people who stay and make it work are weak or, you know, selling out or, you know, purely acting on privilege or, you know, living in drudgery through something that they hate. These people that I know who sort of really stick it out, many of them are some of the most wise, deep, joyful, healthy, happy people I've ever met. And so I really validate what your sort of what you stand for and what you represent. I want you to know that. And the only sort of small point I'm trying to make is the people that I respect most, I think, are the ones who can say, hey, there's a couple paths here. There's the staying path and the leaving path. They're both awesome. They're both amazing. And if you want to stay, here's how to do it. But if you need to leave, here's how to do it. And you can find awesomeness and joy either way. And I'm not even going to steer you in one direction or the other. I want you to know that both options are available and which one feels right to you. Because I do know plenty of deep and wise and amazing people who left, and even some who left quickly. And I know many people who stayed way too long, sometimes 10, 20 years, and still felt like it was damaging to them, wasted time, wasted money, wasted effort. And so I do think that for some, staying even a year or two can be too long, again, depending on their personal situation, their cost-benefit ratio, and what their situation is. So that's the only point I want to make is I would love for us both to develop language that's empowering to both sides, that shows each side is equally legitimate, and that encourages people to find what works for them, not seeks to entice towards one or the other.
Right. Now, would your healthy path outside the church still have language like a spiritual path or a growth path or life more abundant, some sense of you being larger than your body, than your mind, the chemicals in your body? Do you feel like somebody can have a rich and powerful life without at least some kind of playing in things beyond what your normal day-to-day experience says about you in life?
Yeah, that's a great question. Margie and I've been developing this project called the Mormon Transitions Project. And right. I was talking to Margie this weekend about sort of a tagline for the site. And what we settled on was connection, healing, and growth for transitioning in post-Mormons. And the only reason I mention that is because growth is right there in the title. Now, as far as let's just say spirituality or a belief in something bigger or, you know, something meaningful outside of what science could really observe and describe, so there's sort of how I view the world and other people and then how I think myself. And I absolutely believe, you know, there's lots of people who consider themselves spiritual and not religious. And there's a lot of people that I really respect that still believe in God or still believe in some sort of spirituality or just power or force in nature that acknowledge. I think science, one of the things, honestly, that I love about science is how it's got built into it this humility, you know, science that's behaving properly. I'm not talking about Hitchens and Dawkins here,
right?
But science that's behaving properly is the first to acknowledge its own limits, and you know, science rarely says we've proven anything. For me, the humility of proper scientific discourse is really impressive because it basically says, here's what the data have shown us so far. And if new data come, then we'll revise. And let's not speak outside of what, of what we're able to claim. So in other words, a good scientist is never going to say science proves that there is no God, right? The best a good scientist would be able to say, observing good science, would be, hey, we haven't found any data that proves that there's a God, but, you know, who knows, maybe someday. Or they'd say, I personally have concluded that there's no God. But it wouldn't be ever good science to say there's no spiritual world, there's no afterlife, there's no God, because science could never really prove a negative. You know what I'm saying? So,
sure.
So I understand your concerns about Dawkins and Hitchens and Harris and others when it comes to those sorts of things. And I also agree that it's very easy for us who have been conditioned to follow prophets and scriptural text and to give our unwavering devotion to an organized church, once we leave, to sort of just swap out, you know, Monson for Hitchens and Book of Mormon for, you know, pick your, you know, atheist sort of book, and just sort of, again, not doing the deeper work of finding your own center and your own sense of orienting towards the universe. So honestly, most of the wise people that I know that are atheists or agnostic would agree with this. They would say, yeah, don't dogmatically follow Monson or the Book of Mormon. Don't dogmatically follow Harris or Hitchens or Dawkins or any of that stuff. Like, you know, become your own person and use your own understanding of emotion and intellect and data and life experience to orient your world. And so I'm with you on that. And then as far as there being sort of another realm or spiritual realm, you know, I personally still am attracted to the idea that there's meaning and purpose in this existence. I'm still attracted to the idea that I can feel vibes or energy or influence that's outside of what I can really explain, that can sometimes influence or guide or inspire me. You know, when Bach or Beethoven or, you know, a writer or whoever claims that a songwriter, that a poet, that they've received just some channeling of inspiration. Like I resonate with feeling that, because I feel like whatever spirit, you know, I used to feel was telling me the church was true when I was a devout Orthodox believing Mormon, I feel like that same sort of inspiration led me to do Mormon Stories and all the other things I've done. And I don't jump to some conclusion that it's necessarily all my chemicals and neurons and just what's inside my brain. I guess I'm open to the idea that there are energies or powers or influences or forces or meaning or purpose outside of my own realm of existence. But I guess I temper that with an equal sort of awareness that it very well could be just me making meaning that I manufacture, and that there isn't really necessarily any identifiable meaning or purpose. And so for me, that's where faith comes back into play, but just in a very loose sense, where I'm like, yeah, I hope there's an afterlife. I hope that there's some meaning and purpose. I'm going to live as though there's meaning and purpose and some sort of design or end or sort of after purpose, that this doesn't, you know, that someday the earth and the universe isn't just going to explode and everything that we did as a human race is just going to, you know, be reduced to atoms again. Like, I really am in this because I feel like I'm working towards something that's going to continue building. And that, for me, that's what God is now. That's what spirituality is. That's what faith is. That's what hope is. It's just sort of this optimistic, sort of hope that everything we're doing here is going to keep making some type of meaningful difference in the future. And I guess the only thing I'd add is just to say, I could be totally wrong. I think I'm just totally guessing and it could be manufactured, but I'm not going to like poo-poo that and tell everybody they're stupid if they believe that. But I'm also going to be really humble about it and say, I could be totally wrong, you know?
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
And I bet we're pretty similar on some of those things.
Yeah, no, I resonate with that. And honestly, even the fact that there may be no ultimate meaning, there may be no plan and things like that, I just became comfortable with that as a possibility. And so the way I interact with ideas that are powerful or something like that is like, How are these things playing in my chest? How are these things playing in my heart? Do these things open up compassion within me? Do these things open up energy sources that make me say, I want to be bigger than I am now? And so even if they ultimately, you know, are just, you know, nothing from God or some source, the fact that they act on me is plenty for my saying I'm having a flourishing life. You know, I just like try to feel ideas in my heart. And that's why when I say about Givens and these Mormon ideas that obviously captivate him and captivate me, they may not be true in any kind of ultimate sense other than, man, they have woken me up to not just live my life about exactly what's surrounding me every day, you know, just my own problems and things like that. They added a sense of significance to my journey.
Yeah. And I just want you to know that I think of, when I think about Mormonism, I think about Christ and his call towards, you know, being loving and compassionate and service and charity and forgiveness and love and the fruits of the Spirit. And to this day, when I like, let's just say, watch General Conference, there's a part of me that when I hear the Mormon Tabernacle Choir sing, or I hear a really good talk, I feel that expansiveness still. Now, I feel that expansiveness outside of Mormonism in many ways as well, but I still value an emphasis on that and orientation towards that. And the only sort of quick response I have to kind of counter that or provide balance to it is, I've studied a little bit about emotions as a psychologist, and I can say that, you know, you talk in Ephesians or wherever, I was raised in Mormonism to think about the fruits of the Spirit as love and patience and
kind, Galatians 5,
yeah. Okay, Galatians, yeah. And then you know that contention is of the devil, right? And that if I feel happy in all those fruits of the Spirit in Galatians, then I'm the Spirit's with me. But if I feel dark or angry or unsettled, then, well, that's Satan or that's bad. You know what I mean? And what I've come to start thinking now after 6 years training in psychology is that when I feel anger, right? When I feel anger, yeah, I feel the same things that are associated with Satan in Mormonism, right? But instead of now seeing that anger or that frustration or whatever as being dark and negative and evil, now I look at anger as a very important emotion that doesn't make me feel expansive at the time, right?
Sure.
But what it does is it's sort of alerting me to the fact that I've been exposed to something that's either unhealthy or unjust. And it's basically my emotions saying, hey, this is a problem. And I'm going to let you know it's a problem because you're going to feel awful and angry and you're going to tremble.
Sure.
And that's like important. It's not Satan. That's like important information now, not fruits of evil. And so it's not that expansive, enlightened feeling, but it's important information now. And so I can look at that and say, wow, I need to pay attention to that. What's that about? Let me process that. Let me talk about it. Let me explore that. And maybe it'll take a week or a month or a year or 5 years. But as long as you don't get stuck in that anger can become a motivation to propel you towards the growth and the expansiveness that you're talking about later. But you had to kind of go through it and process it and make meaning out of it before you're able to get there. And so while I want to affirm the expansiveness that you talk about, I also now want to sort of validate and affirm anger and sadness and frustration and rage and all the other sorts of things as well.
Sure.
Because like the Disney movie, the Pixar movie.
I thought of that as you were talking too.
Yeah.
Sadness on the opposite side of joy. Yeah.
I loved that movie because it's basically saying all our emotions are important, not just the warm, fuzzy ones, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I know you're not saying that, but I mean, that's just my response.
No. Yeah. And the gal, yeah. You know, there's no Satan in my worldview at all and all that stuff too. So I can't think of a thing you said in this last little section that I disagree with.
Yeah. Well, I'm just saying that the expansiveness is great, but there's other emotions that I pay attention to and value now as well. Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. One of the most powerful books I ever read was called something. I know there's one word I'm missing out, but it was Despair in the Nuclear Age. And it was basically Joanna Macy, who is, you know, talking about this feeling of dread and stuff that so many of us, you know, started to walk around with in the 70s and the 80s as we really realized the nuclear age was on us. And she was like, you know, you got to own that despair. You've got to own those feelings. You got to follow them all the way down before you can get healthy again. And that's absolutely what you're saying. It's just powerful. So, no, I love all that. And in fact, when I taught college, you know, even when you're reading an argument, I would just tell your students, you know, if you're just vaguely uncomfortable with somebody's argument, you may not at first be able to see where it is in that person's premises or stuff that don't add up for you, but follow that feeling of discomfort and why is this striking me wrong? Why is this off base? And trace it down, and then you can kind of really get to where you'll see the clarity of why that doesn't add up for you. So good stuff. Well, in some ways you've done a lot of, one of the things I'd planned today was to really talk to you about the particularities of your belief, because you are, you know, kind of, you wear fairly comfortably this, public persona. You wear, you know, you know that you're a leader. I don't know if you like the idea of that you're a thought leader. I think when you opened up Mormon Stories, you weren't thinking of it as John DeLynn and his ideas. You were just like, hey, I want stories to be told. Whereas clearly over the last few years, you know, it's you know, more and more we know that John isn't just asking questions on behalf of the audience, you know, this certain segment, you know, that seemed like when you interviewed me 5 years ago, it was like many people would want to say, and, you know, I suspected that you were part of that cohort, but now it's clearer that, you know, you've kind of shared what does and what doesn't work for you. But, so you are this leader, and I wanted to chase down your own beliefs about God, whether or not you feel like you have a spirit, what is the nature of human beings and things like that. I'm just going to trust that kind of that came out, you know, in what we just talked about. Is there anything you'd want to say about your positive beliefs? Like, I do still affirm this or something like that. Or should we just leave what you just said?
Yeah, no, I'll just say that I still believe in all the virtues of love and kindness and forgiveness and compassion and charity and all that stuff. I still believe in the importance of community. I acknowledge to you that for me, if there's one main ingredient of religion, it's community. I think that's probably the most important active ingredient of a successful religious experience. And I'm pained by the fact that many post-Mormons and post-religious people don't have always a healthy, strong community to go to. And I think that sometimes really is a disadvantage for many, not all. So I still really value that. And as far as kind of, I just caught myself not wanting to say supernatural, based on my
I don't believe in the
previous conversations
either
with you, but, based on God, you know, this may sound kind of cutesy, but I sort of, you know, my perspective on God is nobody really knows, that we're all just either hoping or guessing or prematurely concluding. And for me, the best thing that we can do, you know, this sort of saying of I believe in life before death. In other words, the most we can do is live the most meaningful, healthy, happy now, because we may not get tomorrow. And so trying to put a form or a substance to God for me is sort of just conjecture and not the best use of time, you know? And so it's not that I'm running around calling myself an atheist or agnostic. It's not that I'm denying the existence of God. I don't think I've ever done that. It's just me saying, I do reject the basic premise of religion as I have sort of come to understand it in most of its incarnations, which is that God will speak to that other dude, and it's usually a dude. and then, you know, that person lived a long time ago, and so we have to read their text from hundreds or thousands of years ago to get what they claim God said to them. And then we have to also experience that through the filter of modern leaders who hold themselves up as the guardians of interpreting what God said through that other person. That just feels incredibly inefficient to me. And I just kind of reject that premise now. And I waited for decades for God to really speak to me. And I felt these inspiration things, but never anything that I could say, yep, there's a supreme being over there telling me to do this or that. And so until God really speaks to me with any of level, with any of the same level of specificity that he supposedly spoke to the Book of Mormon prophets or Joseph Smith or whoever, or Allah or Muhammad or whatever, when he wants, or she or it wants to speak to me with that level of specificity, I will listen. But I'm not going to believe that level of specificity as filtered through all these other people who could have been lying, who could have been just influenced by their time. That's just a broken model for me now, you know? Yeah.
Well, and I guess my one pushback in this would be, you know, you called this religion, and I definitely get it when it comes to the religions, you know, in terms of, you know, leaders from the past and, you know, believe us more and somehow we have a different kind of experience than you and things like that. However, the deep teachings of every religion, or even not deep, but the ones that, you know, get lost in the institutional story and the, you know, the fact that that kind of comes front and center, is that it's not just for them to have their experience, but for you to have the same experience of them. You know, Joseph Smith, Brigham Young, you know, Moses, everybody says, oh, I wish that everyone were prophets. Oh, I wish and I invite everyone to have this same level of experience. And then as I was talking about kind of gaining your own spiritual independence and kind of your own sense of who you are with God and things like that and how God works with you, you know, John, there's not a single... You know, I think God works with me in exactly the way, same way that God would work with leaders of the church and things like that. And so at a certain point, I think you gain enough confidence in your own connection that, you know, they always say, weigh what we say against your own spiritual insight. Well, guess what? I've done that. And I've just come to the point where I think the invitation to be, to have your own experience, I've accepted that. I've gotten to the point where I just don't worry about those guys. And that's what I was trying to say. You kind of become spiritually independent within your own religion. Boy, that's the start. And that's what we're called to do by our own religion. You know, all this follow the prophet stuff is, you know, that's not the deep teaching of Mormonism. That's not the thing that it's pointing to. That's like for the children that we continue on as adults. We continue to call ourselves children of God instead of adults of God. We're not seeking adulthood, and yet all that stuff is all over our scriptures.
Right, right. And I, you know, I want you to know that if you'd asked me a year or year and a half ago, I think I would have said to you, Dan, I do feel spiritually independent. I feel like whatever I feel about the divine, I feel confident in my relationship. I feel independent. And, you know, part of the real big complexity with 21st century Mormonism is this notion of, you know, ecclesiastical roulette that I know you know more than anybody about. Because at some point, it's not just... You know, I concede that every major world religion has this core message of develop the divine within. I totally acknowledge that, right?
Awake to your own divinity, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I completely agree, including Mormonism. However, if you're living in the LDS Church, if you decide that you want to be open and honest with your leader, you could very well get a leader that when you tell them your very empowered, independent thoughts and feelings, they may say, sorry, give me your temple recommend. They may say, sorry, you can't attend the wedding of your own child or grandchild. They may say, you know, sorry, you know, you know, you're excommunicated, right, or you're evil, or, you know, my spirituality trumps your spirituality. And then in the most egregious cases, like you and I have talked about, they may tell you, oh, yes, you're gay, but you should try and go to this therapy, LDS family, yeah, services person that's going to cure you of your homosexuality, or you should go marry this, yeah, woman and let me give you a blessing because God tells me to tell you that, you know, that you should marry this woman, even though you're attracted to men, and that it's going to work out okay. And, or that you masturbated and that's evil and you can't take the sacrament, and the shame and the guilt that you develop can become toxic. And so, you know, you mentioned, you know, the follow the prophet message is for children, but in some ways that's the problem, because these children can become very impressionable by the dogmatic, exclusivistic sort of man-based teachings of these sometimes very authoritative, dogmatic leaders. And it can become very toxic depending on who you are and what your experience is. And so I concede that about striving for our own mature, independent experiences. But I'll also say that for some people, the lived experience is simply intolerable or toxic, you know? And it just depends on who your bishop is, where you live, how comfortable you are being direct versus not, being quiet versus not, you know, using language that you know in some way is deceiving versus not. And everybody's going to probably find different thresholds, you know, and experiences there, right?
Yeah. Now, I've got a couple areas. I want to expand your view of church beyond the institution, and I want to kind of go down that road. But even right there, deceiving versus, you know, a word like not wise to share, those seem to me to be a distinction. In other words, you know, when it comes to leadership roulette, when it comes to self-disclosure and things like that, I think there's a lot of people who and we got into this a little bit in, when you talked with me earlier, you know, is Sunday and is your ward really the community that you should share all your complexity with? Is there some level of discretion that we need to have and an understanding of what is the purpose of gathering on Sunday, and how does this play into the idea, like I was trying to push, that, you know, when I see the church, I don't think institution, I don't think my ward, I don't think my bishop and things like that. I think this entire body of Christ. I think of you, I think of me, I think of my, you know, the Thoughtful Faith Facebook group that I, you know, a moderator of and things like that. We are church, and we are Mormonism, and I think it's wonderful and great for all those things that you say that I need to share. I don't think you need to share those with your leaders. I think, you know, we as Mormonism are doing a good job of saying, this is also church. This is also us. Share away, wrestle with each other.
Okay. So there is a level, you know, and of course, you know, I wrote the essay at StayLDS.com about managing your capital at church and being careful about what things you bring up and how, you know, why would you want to spoil someone else's Sunday at church and just keep those things to yourself and find a good community where you could talk about these things. And, you know, I completely understand the argument of what the purpose of Sunday is. It's to build community, to feel spirituality. It's not to debate polyandry and peepstones and to bring up disturbing things and to spoil people's spiritual experiences. There's a level, Dan, where I obviously very, very much agree with you and your argument towards, you know, about discretion. And I would just say, you know, there's two responses I would have. One is that, it depends on what type of community you really want to have. And what I would argue is just like there's a milk before meat, you know, this idea of deeper levels, you know, some would argue that in the church today, there's never a place where meat is ever really talked about in the institutional church. But even going to something that I seem to remember with something I read from M. Scott Peck a long time ago, there's a notion of a superficial community and then a notion of a deep, rich community. And I'll just say that I had a friend contacting me just this week, and he said to me, you know what, I've got, you know, there's a bishop and my bishop is realizing that there's 5 or 10 people leaving the church in his ward. And, you know, I think we should talk about this stuff at church because so many people are leaving and are troubled. And I think that there's a degree to which that's risky, but there's a degree to which I was like, that's really inspiring. That's a bishop who realizes that for a deeper, richer, more meaningful community, we should be able to talk about abortion or abuse or racism or historical problems, that if we could find a way to go deeper, even in our Sunday discussions, that provides the possibility for even more meaningful spiritual experiences and connection.
Sure.
And I think that's what draws people to Mormon Matters and A Thoughtful Faith, honestly, is that that's where they can have those types of experiences. And so I guess I want to say, on the one hand, I agree with you. And on the other hand, I want to challenge that and say, wow, what if Sundays were people being more authentic, more raw, more challenging topics? What if, like, these communities could go from something that feels a little bit surfacey and superficial to something really more deep and meaningful, you know?
Okay. Yeah. Well, two responses back. One, would you agree or disagree that, well, first of all, let me do the other one first. When I say Sunday isn't the place for these sorts of things and disclosures, it doesn't mean that at certain points I don't disclose, or that people who are, you know, have a strong view on GLBT or something like that don't, you know, just simply say, let's stop this discussion right now. This is harmful. Let's realize what we're doing here. Let's see the big picture. I don't think what we're doing here is representative of Christ, etc. And we can do that. So don't think that I'm arguing that people wouldn't do that, because I know that that's been successfully and powerfully done.
I understand that.
The second thing is,
I read the A Thoughtful Faith Facebook group, and it inspires me.
Yeah. John Grimes lately is with a couple of things that he's been sharing. Yeah. The other thing is, though, would you agree or disagree, and this is where I was going to first, that if you were going to do that, if we were going to have these more public wrestles, would it be okay to, like, designate for those who have difficulties or questions, here is a Sunday school class, or here is, you know, a series of lecture or a series of firesides we're going to do? Can you see the need to signal that ahead of time, or would you just thrust that on everybody?
Oh, of course. There's absolutely – there's people who just don't want to know. It wouldn't be good for them to know. You know, I had a guy in Elders Quorum once say, I was trying to give these edgy, controversial lessons, you know, and he raised his hand and he said, I don't want to sit here and have a thoughtful, stimulating discussion. I want people to just tell me what to do, and I want to do it. My life is really intense. It's difficult. And this isn't usual to me. I just want someone to tell me what to do and do it. And I think that's something that we should respect. So yeah, I totally agree with you there. And I've heard of, you know, in Berkeley or Cambridge or other places where there's sort of two Sunday schools, a more progressive one. I think that in practicality that also has potential complications. But yeah, I love that idea. I'm going to just respond with one final thing in this discussion, particularly, and that's having to do with honesty again, and particularly around interviews with ecclesiastical leaders and the temple recommend question, because there was a time where I thought, oh, I can't go to the temple. I can't have my temple recommend because I don't believe anymore. And then I became exposed to you and others, and I wrote the essay on Stay LDS. And ultimately I was like, oh no, we can mean different things by the words that we use, and we can interpret the temple recommend questions in different ways. And that's the way the church intended it. And we're supposed to be our own judge after all. And so there was a good couple years where I was like, I'm completely fine answering the temple recommend questions as they anticipate that I should, knowing full well that what I mean is different than what they mean, but that why go there, right? And then I'm just telling you that for me, there I reached a point where I felt like I was being deceitful. And so that's when I went to Mark Jensen, my previous state president, and laid it all on the table, right? And I said, we're going to have hours and hours of conversations about what I really do and don't believe, because I feel like I want to be a member in good standing where I'm open and honest and not dissembling or speaking in code or deceiving you. And I just want to, I want to be a member in full standing, not in hiding, but in full disclosure of how I see the world. And the crazy thing was, by the end of those dialogues with Mark Jensen, he said, you're worthy in every way to remain a member in full standing. And he let me ordain my son, and he let me, you know, partake in the Melchizedek priesthood offices and whatever. And then zero changed about my beliefs between then and Brian King a year later. And Brian King tells me that my beliefs are unacceptable, right, and excommunicable.
And never even really inquired for himself about you.
Yeah. I mean, you know, we had the conversation once. It was after I had cornered him. It was after I had embarrassed him through a New York Times article. And it was sort of like, okay, I have to show an interest. So tell me where you stand on all these things. Okay, time's up. And then the very next lesson, you know, the very next time together, he had his letter with all his conditions of maintaining my membership, telling me that my beliefs were unacceptable. And so I think that I don't judge someone who feels comfortable speaking in code to get a temple recommend or withholding. But I think sometimes I worry that when you speak about somebody who says, I can't hide, I can't speak in code, I need to be honest. Sometimes what I hear you communicate in the way I interpret it is you're saying, that's dumb. That's not right. You don't need to be fully honest. You don't need to disclose everything. You can sort of keep speaking in code and just sit with the differences and keep them private. And I would just say, I would want to hear someone in your position say, I can see why you would want to be nuanced, but I can see why for some people they can't do that. And I respect both paths. Not that the wiser, deeper, more mature path is to speak in code. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and I would never, the term speak in code, you know, that's peppered your last couple minutes. I would never even consider it that as much as like you come into the interview with the biggest picture in mind and understand what you're, what's in front of you, and that this person could not possibly understand you in the course of these questions, and that he's doing his pro forma job and inquiry, and certainly I'm sure he has his discernment filters on and things like that, and if things come for him up for him in the course of that, then of course, you know, share more. But I'm just saying, you know, when you're talking leadership roulette, here's one of the places to avoid throwing your power to somebody else.
No, I hope I was clear. I lived that for many years. I validate that as a legitimate approach. And, I'll retract the term speak in code. And I'll just say that there was a point where I really realized that what I meant, if they knew what I really meant when I answered the questions the way I answered, that they would probably not want me to have that temple recommend.
But
I know that's giving them power, but in some sense they are a gatekeeper, and I wanted to be fully authentic. I just felt the urge and the need at some point to be fully open and authentic and to say, I don't want you to believe, I don't want you to leave this meeting with a different understanding than what is reality. When I say God, I mean something very different than you. And when you say atonement and Jesus and resurrection, I mean something very different. And when you say word of wisdom, I mean something different. And when you say, belief in the restoration, I mean something very different. And I don't want to have to, if you're going to be the gatekeeper, I want to be the gatekeeper with us both having an identical understanding of what I mean when I answer your questions. Because if I'm not legitimate with my full authentic answers, then that's important to me, because you really are the gatekeeper and you're empowered to do this job. And if the church ultimately doesn't want me as my full, open, authentic self, then I don't want to be here, you know? Because it's not – for me, it's my relationship with my wife. If I'm keeping things from her, if I'm holding back, for me, it's not true intimacy. For me. I'm not saying this is true for everybody, but for me, I don't want to keep anything from Margie. And I don't want to have to hide who I am from Margie. And I want her to know all the truth, all the facts, all the nuance, and still feel loved and accepted by her. And to me, that's the greatest relationship you can have. And lots of people.
But that unfolds over a lifetime, and there's a lot of time, a 10 or 15 minute moment when you simply say, I expect you to even have a glimpse of understanding of me after that 10 or 15 minutes. That's like insanity to think that they're going to even understand you. They may know, oh, he is claiming difference here, but they can't know that you actually put it together well in your heart. So simply declare that you've put it well together in your heart and move on, because, again, you know, you're making that person be the church. If the church doesn't want me in the temple, if the church doesn't want me in full fellowship, this is a person who doesn't know you, whereas you and God are hopefully good together, and all he needs to do is sense with his feeling of, you know, green light or red light. And if he starts to sense something other than green light, go ahead and start the probing question. But I just don't see, you know, again, I'm just, no, we've gone around these rounds before.
No, and I'll just say,
but you're not going to be disclosed. They're not going to understand you, and therefore it's a fool's errand to try.
Okay. I think this is a good chance to model what I've been trying to say in other segments. And that's that I concede your approach as valid for those for whom it works. I see the wisdom in it. I see it as empowering and as liberating. Almost everything that you just said is what I wrote into the why, how to stay in the church after a crisis of faith essay on Stay LDS. I think it's a valid approach. And I think it's also two things. I think it's valid for someone to say, I'm sick of not being fully open and authentic, and I feel the need to be. I think that is also a legitimate decision.
And so if we expand the definition of church beyond the leaders, then you can do that within Mormonism.
What do you mean?
I can fully be myself in Facebook groups, in online discussions, in study groups and things that I put together.
But I mean with the gatekeepers that are going to decide if I'm going to be shamed in front of my congregation when my son's going to get baptized, that's going to get shamed if, you know, when my son is proceeding through the offices of the priesthood, whether I'm going to get shamed if I'm going to go on a mission or get to go to the temple or get to engage in a wedding. To me, if other people, if I know, I reached a point where I knew about ecclesiastical roulette and that maybe I was lucky and had a good bishop. And these bishops exist. Bishops take presidents that are like, I don't care if you're an atheist. You can go to the temple. I don't care if you, you know, believe that Jesus was resurrected. You can go to the temple. You can get anywhere from that to someone who is very orthodox and literal. And for me, I reached a point where I said, I'm uncomfortable with the disparity and with the power that we're giving these people. And it just doesn't feel, you know, it's kind of like the people, my friends, who sort of held out getting married until gay and lesbian people could get married. And then they went and got married because they sort of said, I want to be a part of an institution that's just at its core just and honorable and not excluding people. And I'm, you know, there's flaws in that argument, but I have respect for that. And for me, this comes back to this notion of privilege. If I'm sitting there in my church experience, oh, I'm tall or powerful or have a podcast or I'm you know, educated in certain ways or can use the right flowery language, and I get to go to the temple, but then I have to look at these other parents suffering in pain as their kids get married and they're excluded from the temple because they had the wrong bishop. At some point for me to just go, well, I'll enjoy that privilege while other people suffer, I reached a point where that just felt like I was being complicit in a system that wasn't worthy. And I just, again, my ideal would be to hear from Dan Witherspoon both, hey, here's one approach that Dan does, and it's awesome, and it's valid, and it's legitimate. And for people who feel called to this and are sensitive about privilege and conscience and disparity, that's a totally noble and worthy thing too. And both are legitimate. That's all I'm hoping for in this type of discussion.
I'll give it to you. Yeah, and I didn't really intend for us to talk about temple recommends so much as, but I know it's a big issue, and my disclosure, and I think it came out in your thing, is I haven't sought a temple recommend in quite a while. You know, I'll keep reasons to myself, but it certainly wouldn't be the worthiness interview or the worries over, you know, what the belief systems. To me, the temple recommend interview is far more important on the practice issues. Do you pay your tithing? Do you obey the word of wisdom, et cetera? Are you honest and things like that? Those are the key things. The belief stuff, like I kind of was hinting before, I don't think you can get somebody inside your head and your lifelong wrestle or your many year wrestle, you know, for those things.
Yeah.
And so I choose not to pay tithing right now to this institution. So I'm not seeking a recommend, but I didn't want anyone to think that I'm actually doing this right now. But I think in my heart would be completely at peace with the fact that, you know, I've made peace with this. God and I are good. I'll not profess to do something that I don't do, but on the belief stuff, I don't need full disclosure with this person who wouldn't have time in 10 or 15 minutes to even glimpse me.
Totally. And there's a mentor of mine, a very respected woman within progressive Mormonism who hasn't sought a temple recommend in decades. And I respect her, and she's still active in her ward and very engaged. And the only thing I would just say is, for me, I just made this decision, and this was like in 2013, that I refuse to be a second class citizen in my church where I'm excluded from the most visible and important and public sort of rituals. I refuse to be excluded from my own child's wedding if it means that I have to be open and honest. And so that was important to me. I basically, when Oaks gave his talk in late 2013, and I said, the church is coming after same-sex marriage again, I have to speak out. I made a decision then that I am going to be 100% open and honest to speak out for those who are disadvantaged and hurting and suffering. And a condition for my continued participation is that I'm a member in full standing, because I will not be shamed and relegated to second class status by being excluded from these very public ordinances. To me, that's unacceptable. It causes so much pain and suffering. It causes so many people to lie. Oh, coincidentally, my daughter's about to get married, and all of a sudden my views have become a lot more, you know, faithful and progressive. And then the kid gets married, and then it's like, oh, I can let my temple recommend lapse now. I mean, all that is, and just all the people who just bold-faced lie to get the temple recommend. And then all the people that get excluded and shamed. That's just that there's something really fundamentally wrong about the way that power and rituals are officiated in this church. And to me, I didn't want to be a part in that. But I understand people that feel okay with it. I don't judge them.
Would you argue for an open temple? Everybody gets to come?
Oh, yeah. Of course.
You would. Okay. Yeah. So, all right. So that'd be an interesting discussion for us to do.
Well, I mean, I know that it's going to hurt the church in some ways. So I acknowledge.
Oh, on weddings and things like that. I'm 100% for that. I think that we could easily accommodate non-members into a temple wedding. Yeah, absolutely. But I meant, like, in general, in other words, should there be some sort of level of commitment, level of disciplines, you know, whether it's financial disciplines or bodily disciplines or whatever, you know, the way you live your life thing, before you go to a place of covenant making and things like that. In other words, I do think that there's a right to have a certain level of gatekeeping for this, for these rituals, because, you know,
but just not for private personal growth and spirituality, absolutely. But when it's tied to giving money to the church, and when it's such a public shaming, you know, to such fundamental rituals like coming of age or marriage or basic ordinances for your children, then I think that's gross, you know?
Yeah.
To me.
Well, yeah, no, and I faced that with my son and ordaining him to the priesthood.
Our first episode together on Forma Stories.
I definitely have felt the sting of it.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.